Hi, my name is Tom Lynch, Miskatonic River Press, and I'm enrolled at Miskatonic University Podcast. Go Pods!
It is a center for higher learning. It is a place with centuries of secrets in its shadowed halls. This is where you have come to learn the mysteries of the cosmos. Welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast.
Sponsored by CryptoCurium.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast, episode 34. This is the podcast dedicated to Call of Cthulhu and other horror and Lovecraft-related role-playing games. I'm Keeper Dan.
And I'm Keeper John. Welcome, everybody.
And I'm Keeper Chad.
And in episode 34, we're going to talk about tips for describing the indescribable.
Plus, we'll go back to the bestiary and we'll announce the result. Oh, no, we won't. Oh, God, I wrote that. Sorry. Oh, we will result.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. Okay. In 3, 2, 1. Plus, we go back to the bestiary and we'll announce the results of the Atomic Age History Contest.
And we have a review of Tales of the Sleepless City from Miskatonic River Press.
And we got more. But first, let's open up the Campus Crier.
Miskatonic University Campus Crier.
Campus Crier is Miskatonic U student paper. Here's where we're going to go through our feedback and news. And as a little extra bonus, thanks to the wonderful time travel of podcasting, we now also have Murph with us. Yay!
Hey.
We got a full house.
All right.
We're special that way.
We're going to start off by announcing the winner of our Atomic Age History Contest, and that would be Gladius for his... How do you pronounce that? Datlov? Datlov Paz incident?
Yes. With 100% of the precincts reporting, Gladius garnered 52% of the vote, with the remainder split between Sutter family UFO attack at 28%, and fall of Holy City, California, taking 20% of the ballots. I'll be in touch with Gladius about the arrangements and the segment. Dan, back to you in our studio.
That was awesome. We should do that more often.
Nice.
We need like a one of those teletype sound effects in the background.
Yes.
I'll have to find
play
one.
Play constantly after everyone talks.
And now Chad from the field. Coming to you live.
Do it from a helicopter.
You can hear the fire and you can hear the more.
Yes, there is celebration in the streets.
No, Chad's reporting from the front lines of the Great War. How's it like? What's it like there in France, Chad?
C'est la vie.
Give those Dominicans hell.
Gunshots and croissants.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Oh yeah, Chad, tell us about Brett Kramer, please.
Okay, well, with I'm under heavy fire here, but yeah, so Brett Kramer's ramping up his Lovecraft Country newsletter. He's calling it the Arkham Gazette, and I've gotten a little sneak peek, and I gotta say it's pretty great stuff. It's all totally focused on New England and the classic era. So it'll be articles about New England history, it'll be actual scenarios. He's already got some great stuff in there, and he'll be looking for contributions. So,
oh, awesome.
Yep. So the theme of the inaugural issue is Rhode Island. So he's obviously getting ready to release that, hopefully, in Providence.
Yeah, I was going to say, gee, I wonder if it's going to have anything to do with Providence.
What a weird coincidence.
Yes.
Wonder if it'll show up at Necronomicon.
And Saturday, June 15th. Was the 15th anniversary of Yogg-Sothoth.com.
That is amazing.
Yay.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Good job, guys.
And to celebrate, they're giving away a early copy of PDF of the Masks of Nyarlathotep Companion, which has been in the works for the last, six or so years. And it's still not even quite done with the editing yet, but it is beautiful and it is usable.
and go and get it. There's going to be links in the show notes.
Yeah, it's going to be an amazing book with all kinds of extra scenarios and NPCs and advice on how to kind of update it for the style of play that has evolved over the years. Mm-hmm. So it's not a straight shoot 'em up in some of those scenes. It's got more depth, and yeah, it's great stuff.
Yeah, the table of contents is like 4 pages long. It's just crazy and beautiful, and I've been reading through it little bits at a time, and it's just amazing. Also, they've recently put out a new Silver Lodge, which if you're a patron, you get the full version of that, and where they have a nice talk with Helen about the Archaeologist's Handbook. And then also recently, they've put out an interview with Sandy Peterson about Cthulhu Wars. And so he talks all about the game. And if you're a patron, there's also an extra little chat with him, maybe 15, 20 minutes, where Paul and he talk about Kickstarter in general, and also Sandy's thoughts on the Call of Cthulhu 7th edition.
Very cool.
I listened to those today, and it was a really good interview. So everybody can hear the Cthulhu Wars talk,
yeah,
so
I
go and get
that part today. It was great.
Yeah, it's a beautiful looking game, too.
Mm-hmm.
Great pieces, and yeah, having heard that interview, it really sounds like something that'll be fun to play.
I know.
With the different factions having different powers. And
Sandy is actually in Dallas tomorrow running a game of Cthulhu Wars. And I'm
gonna
very tempted
down?
To go. I'd be driving up, and it'd be about a 4.5-hour trip, and I'm broke as all get out. So that's a no, but I'd really like to.
Yeah. They even have a level where you can pledge, I think it's like $10 or $11 to cover shipping, and then you can just purchase the add-ons. They've got a t-shirt that looks awesome, and you can just, for like $20, you can just individually buy their large scale miniatures. So if you want to just get Cthulhu,
really cool.
You can. I love that. It's brilliant.
Yeah, the cultist. They have the cultist pack, or the what is it mm-hmm. called? The cult leader. I can't remember what it's called, but it's the giant cultist that's one for each faction. It's the same cast, but different. It looks different for each one, you know. Or it's different colored for each one. So that's a really fantastic job that they're doing on that game.
I can't wait to see people getting this game in their homes and then start painting up these minis.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to see pictures of these all painted up beautifully.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, and I think it's just, this is just me personally, I think it's an ill-timed Kickstarter, because going back to back against 7E, I know for me, it was a stretch just to contribute to the 7E Kickstarter, and it left me nothing to even consider doing Cthulhu Wars. So I wish it was, you know, even 6 months down the line, because then I would have at least been able to renegotiate with the wife.
I think what we're mm-hmm. going to see is more and more Kickstarters in this time of the year, especially for RPGs and whatnot, because they're all trying to ramp towards Gen Con.
Sure.
So I think that this is going to be a common theme where you're going to have to pick and choose and leave some behind, and some are going to get it and some aren't, you know?
Yeah.
Some might make it that don't need to make it, and some might not that should have, just because of the way the timing is going to work out with Gen Con at the end of the summer.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, but awesome. You know, Cthulhu Wars looks great. So if the listeners haven't checked out, go check it out. There's a great little video, and the pieces look awesome. So moving on, Miskatonic River Press is going to be moving into a state of hibernation. President Tom Lynch is going to focus on his personal career. He just graduated from graduate school and is going to be a teacher. So the best of luck to Tom. You know, he's been an amazing publisher. I mean, absolutely amazing. And if he is, if he's only half as good a teacher as he is a publisher, he has an amazing career ahead of him. So, you know, we, you know, all wish him the best of luck.
Yeah, without
a doubt. Absolutely.
Sad news, but hopefully all those folks are going to be wanting to do something. We know that Oscar has already got his own project going, so it'll have new life in other places.
It will.
Yeah. Yeah, the Crescent City book was going to be an MRP book, and Oscar's picking that up over at Golden Goblins. So,
yep.
Yeah, and he hinted at a Kickstarter at the end of the year for that as well. So, mm-hmm. we should be able to see a Kickstarter for the end of the year for that Crescent City book, which would be really cool.
Yes.
Yeah.
But lest we let Miskatonic River leave, it's actually kind of interesting timing for us here at Miskatonic University Podcast. We actually have a copy of Tales of the Sleepless City to give away in a brand new contest. So we just closed out one for Atomic Age Cthulhu, and now we have a brand new one for Tales of the Sleepless City. Here's how you can enter the contest. Go to Facebook, visit the Miskatonic River Press Facebook page, and find the posting that Tom has just recently put up about the contest. He'll have a Tales of the Sleepless City contest posting. You need to share, not just like, but you need to share that posting, and you need to copy and tag the Miskatonic University podcast in that sharing as well. That is, because if you do that, then MUP is announced. We get flagged that you've done that sharing, and then we'll write down your name. And so we're going to run this contest. How long should we run this? Saturday the 13th at midnight Central Time will be the end of the Facebook contest. So go out there, check out Miskatonic River Press, share the posting that Tom has made about this contest, and be sure to tag MUP, because if you don't tag us, we don't know that you've shared it, and we can't enter your name into the contest.
Rewind the podcast if you didn't understand.
Exactly.
Might take a couple of times. On the same note, we've had a contest hanging forever that I've kind of dropped the ball on, I suppose, with the newsletter namer, right?
Ah, yes.
Is that right?
I apologize to everybody for that. It's been very hectic in general, and it just completely slipped my mind with the myriad of other things that we're doing. The winner is the name that we're using is Cephalophobia. I don't know whose that is, and as soon as I figure that out, I'll tell you. And that person will be the winner. So whoever you are, congratulations.
Okay.
I thought we should say that before I forgot about it again.
Yeah, good call.
Okay, so there's a new podcast out there, guys. It's called the Blasphemous Tomes Podcast, and it's, oddly enough, it's got Paul Fricker, Matthew Sanderson, and Scott Dorward on it. And it's freaking cool.
Oh, man, I got to get that.
Yeah. Yeah, they've got it is cool. 3 episodes and, out there so far.
Yeah.
Yep, and I asked about the whole subscription thing, and it's actually now you can get it on
iTunes.
It is
on iTunes now.
They
yes.
fixed it.
It takes a few days for it to get approved into iTunes.
I see.
So we just came across this the other day. Actually, our listener Hugh told me about it, and I kind of passed it along to the guys. And so far, they've done a great job. They've it's a shorter format. But you know, I think shows are what 45 minutes to an hour or so,
something like that. Yeah, but they've put out 3 episodes so far.
Yeah,
it's at blasphemoustomes.com. Links will be in the show notes. And the podcast itself is called The Close Friends of Jackson Elias,
which is just an awesome name.
Absolutely. And the other half of the 7th E crew, Mike Mason, he's put up a blog. He apparently doesn't feel like throwing his voice out there as often as Paul and, well, us. So he has a blog called The Angry Zoog. So he's got all sorts of cool information up there.
That makes me laugh.
He's actually got a nice,
it is a great name.
It's a good name. He's got a good post up there right now. The top post on there is Myth Dews, Part 1 Scenario Construction, The Initial Spark. So evidently he's going to be doing a series of posts about how to, you know, write your own scenario, which I think is great. Coming from him, that's
yes,
that should be a well read piece of information there. So, are you okay, Chad? We heard the shot.
Yeah, sorry, I just muted. It's going crazy out there.
Is it a gang war, Chad?
Oh, probably. Oh my god.
Chad,
and this
cover.
Is what we get for Chad moving to frickin' New York City.
If you ever wanted to know what nights are like in New York, this is it.
Yeah. You now have an audio tour of New York City. Explosions.
And now, I don't know if you can hear the car alarms that went off because of the explosions.
Are you unfortunate enough
that
to be
ground
level, or are you actually...
I'm on ground level. I'm on ground.
There's a reason why there's that is.
That means a stray shot might come in. That's bad.
That's right.
Yeah, you really should be up a little bit.
I'm in the back of a super cheap Rentha.
There's a reason
I'm in the
for
back
that,
of the building.
Yeah, it's super
anyway,
cheap. So it's only $8,000 a month.
Yeah. Exactly. I don't want to talk about it.
Ian McClellan went out and created our official Fighting Cephalopod mascot, and it's freaking cool.
Yes, he's awesome.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It's so cool. Great.
I wanted to announce it here, but yes, the Fighting Cephalopod will be featured on all sorts of cool swag, and that I already have started up in the planning stages, because it is awesome.
And please buy the swag, because we're poor, and this stuff costs money, so swag helps the show.
That's how I'm getting to Gen Con, guys. So
please buy the swag. Enough said.
Yeah.
You want to tell us about our sponsors?
Yep. Two of them, we actually were on the notes for last show, and we totally missed them.
Oh, my
them.
God.
And so we wanted to make sure and mention them. We had Tony, who is well known in our community, that he's Tack on the forums, and he's, well, Tony in the Skype of Cthulhu podcast. So if you listen to that show, and you should, you've heard Tony. So he is on there, and he's also been on a few of our shows too for our actual play stuff. And then user RJ McReady, he's a sponsor now. Thank you very much. And then also we have Show Not Found.
The Show Not Found is actually sits in the IRC channel quite a bit. And he has his own podcast that he does on gaming-based podcasts that they do on Google Voice.
Nice.
It's a really cool show. Anyway, I forgot the name of it, Show Not Found, so I apologize. But if you send us an email, give me an IRC later, and we'll put it in the show notes.
Yes, we'll make sure and have a link for that.
The reference librarians locate various materials through their familiarity with the contents of the library.
All right. Our card catalog link for this show is going to be one that we use quite a bit for things, and I use it as part of the production for this show, archive.org.
Yeah, there's so much you can say about what is available on this website. I'm thinking specifically of the PDFs that you can get for free of scanned old out-of-print books that you can then use to make props. So, and because they scan the pages, they sort of look a little bit wrinkled. And, you know, if you get the right copy that's not text-only, you get, you know, nice engravings and that kind of thing. And then you can take those and bookletize them and turn them into sort of little pamphlets that feel like, put them on resume paper or something like that. And then you can make props for your games.
That's very cool.
Yeah. And there's stuff up there, like there are classic old catalogs. So you can do a search for a year and just put in catalog, and you'll get all sorts of different things. We'll have links to various examples in the show notes of stuff that you can search for. And so I have found catalogs of, like, old Sears catalogs, old other department store catalogs. I believe I found one that was, like, an old Canadian department store catalog. And then there's also lots and lots of classic vintage house plan books. And, hey, what GM doesn't like to have plenty of house plans at their disposal?
Oh, yeah.
More maps. Totally.
Yep.
This, not to put Chad on the spot, but you were talking about bookletizing, taking scans and converting it into a physical prop. That sounds so cool, but also to me sounds nigh impossible to do. I wouldn't know the first thing about doing something like that.
Oh.
Would Chad, if my memory serves, you actually have experience in doing just this, right? You've created books, even, you know, just, you know, not thick, you know, 2-inch thick tomes, but you've created, like, you know, book pamphlets, right, as props for your game table.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you can take. Yeah.
If you haven't done it yet, would it be possible for you to do a write up of something like that we could share on the website, and then that way, folks who are listening to this now might go do exactly what I was thinking, which is what a great idea. Use that. Use archive.org to mine that for stuff to create a prop, but how would I take it from the idea to the finished product?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to. Yep. And I've got tips for maybe how to search. You know, you can put in, do an advanced search and limit it by year. So if you want something that's really old and has, you know, some of that strange alchemy stuff, do a search for alchemy and then limit it by, you know, pre-1750. And then, and I'd love to, you just take pages, you extract them. You make your own little PDF in multiples of 4. So you do like an 8-page PDF, you'll get kind of a 2-page pamphlet, you know, back to back, folded once. And, so I'll definitely put up some examples and do a little tutorial.
That would be awesome. Yeah. Sorry. Didn't want to put you on the spot.
No, that's good.
I thought what a great opportunity to get a great tips from you on how to create that as a prop.
It's such a burden, John, to share things that I've done that I love with other people. You know,
I've heard you talk so often about how you're going to take all this knowledge of yours to the grave. So
yeah,
pray it out of your hands while we can.
Oh, geez, would you look at that? Ooh, maybe buried pirate treasure.
Well, now that's a little underwhelming.
Hello, how can I help you?
Hello there, is this the Department of Book Learning and Nonsense?
Well, you've reached the Antiquities Department.
Perfect.
Well, that's messy.
Found this out to the Clam Flats, and I want to know what it's worth.
Some kind of yellow sign on the cover.
Well, I need you to read it for me, because I don't speak stupid.
Oh, that lettering. What does that say?
What's that say? Hasta?
Haster.
Hasta.
Haster.
Hasta.
And up next, we've got the review that our own Keeper Chad has recorded on the Tales of the Sleepless City from Miskatonic River Press. This is the scenario book based in New York City. And it's a really nicely rounded out review, and that's going to be about the next 5 minutes.
I'm here in the 42nd Street subway stop under Times Square because I thought it'd be a fitting place to review a recently released book of scenarios from Miskatonic River Press. Tales of the Sleepless City is a book of scenarios set in Jazz Age New York. So I'm going to include some soft spoilers here, mostly plot hooks, locations, and themes that players might not want to hear if they want to go into these adventures cold. To Awaken What Never Sleeps by Dan Harms begins in the thick of the action with a subway disaster that really happened right here in 1928 at Times Square. That hook gets investigators involved right away and then haunts them in a way that keeps them engaged later on. It's a solid scenario that plays well and moves along at a good clip, and I like very much that it draws from an H.P. Lovecraft story called He, and that it introduces some new urban-flavored magic. Next, The Terror from the Museum by Brian Sammons also starts in your face. As previously spoiled by the author on this podcast, a professor contacts investigators for protection and help, only to get abruptly ripped apart by unseen forces in front of their eyes, Abdul al-Hazred style. The adventure continues as a bit of a high-action Egyptological romp, and would weave well together with a Masks of Nyarlathotep campaign in both setting and in flavor. Next, we find ourselves way uptown on 125th Street in Harlem to review The Fishers of Men by Charles Michael Hirst, which takes us into the underbelly of 1920s Harlem, where a tide of urbanization and a fierce cultural renaissance brought African-influenced animist religion from the West Indies and the American South. The plot centers on a real culture clash between police and folk medicine practices and includes an unusual entity, with a welcome nod to the fiction of Lynn Carter. The Tenement by Oscar Rios explores a critical component of experience for immigrants in New York. It's kind of a sandbox in a building, in an oddly isolated setting, the way neighborhoods and buildings here can feel like enclosed worlds unto themselves. Rios populates the Hell's Kitchen setting with colorful Dickensian characters that theatrical keepers will enjoy running. Incidentally, there's an amazing tenement museum just a few blocks from here on the Lower East Side on the corner of Delancey and Allen, with immigrant apartments from the 1860s onward restored and recreated for visitors. Check it out if you're ever in the city. A Night at the Opera by Mikael Hedberg honors some of the city's theater history and takes us inside the Met for a race against a cosmic time bomb that would make a perfect one or two night scenario. With the right music and lighting, a keeper could stage a very memorable, high-pressure adventure for their group. Lastly, The Child and the Weeping Mother by Tom Lynch and Scott David Analowski delves into the otherness of classic-era Chinatown. Investigators are pitted against a network of threats, including underworld gangs and good intentions gone horribly wrong. A list of Chinese phrases and terms is a nice touch, and setting background is rich enough to be expanded as a mainstay of a possible New York campaign. H.P. Lovecraft lived in New York for a few years and famously grew to hate the place. He called its population a hopeless tangle and enigma, Syrian, Spanish, Italian, and Negro elements impinging upon one another, and fragments of Scandinavian and American belts lying not far distant. It is a babel of sound and filth, he said. Yeah, he wasn't so fond of the melting pot or the teeming masses yearning to be free. Tales of the Sleepless City faces Lovecraft's themes of fear and otherness in New York head-on, painting a grubby and unsanitized picture of the city's chaos. The sinister artwork by Rich Longmore in this volume will support a keeper's dark imaginings, and generous maps by Steph Worthington and a very kind layout make the book an easy reference to. Paul Carrick's cover painting of a twisted New York public library is frameable. The day I recorded this review was the same day Tom Lynch announced the indefinite retirement of Miskatonic River Press on YSDC. That's very sad news, but the good news is that this book is going to serve as another proud marker of talent in a brief but excellent run of MRP publishing.
What's happening?
We are taking a trip to the museum, and we're going to go over to the ancient civilization section and take a look in some of the glass cases, which hopefully are going to be thoroughly locked, because we're talking about mummies.
Mummies.
I like mummies.
Yeah? Why is that?
I think it's the old, the whole ancient Egyptian thing, you know? I just like mummies. They're cool. They're resurrected intelligent beasts.
Well, yeah, it sort of depends on what kind of mummy you use. I guess in the Call of Cthulhu universe, they are, right? They're not just zombies with bandages.
No.
As Lon Chaney
played. They had potential of being extremely...
But and even that was only a very small bit. The Boris Karloff, anyway.
They had the potential for being extremely capable foes in this system, at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're definitely in the Lovecraft world.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he certainly wrote about them and was fascinated, obviously, by Egyptian history and folklore.
That was definitely an artifact also of his time. In the 20s, it was when they discovered King Tut's tomb, then everything just went Egypt crazy for a while.
Yeah, I was going back to the Under the Pyramid story, mm-hmm. which is kind of, it's sort of like interesting reinvented mummies, these composite mummies that have animal heads.
Yeah.
That's a whole other thing.
Yeah. Well, but, that's the Egyptian gods, you know, that's how they've always been depicted as being human bodies with animal heads.
Right. But I think he proposed that they actually had taken animal heads and put them on some of these mummies, which is not really... That it didn't really happen, but...
Yeah, there weren't any surgical procedures done of stuffed versions of their gods, of using actual animals and people. But, you know, that kind of turns into the Children of the Sphinx creature type that's in the rule books that you can use for any kind of animal you can think of, which makes for just an interesting foe also. Probably at the command of somebody that has been made into a mummy.
Have you guys ever used mummies in your games?
Not in Call of Cthulhu games. I'll be honest, I haven't. I'm thinking we should, though. We should have some mummies somewhere. I'm thinking of a museum adventure. That would be the perfect place for mummies.
Yeah. I've read a few, but I haven't actually used one myself. I've had some that were kind of planned and in the works and just never happened. But there's all sorts of potential because they're kind of like, you know how if you have a vampire, you can basically, for your game, your story, you can kind of set the rules. Okay, what are vampires like in my setting? And as long as you're internally consistent, you can just go with whatever you want to. You can pretty much do the same thing with mummies. You can make them fast, you can make them slow, intelligent, dumb, whatever.
I'm looking in my favorite monster book, the Malleus Monstrorum. Which has mummies listed on page 255. And they mention that, you know, many mummies lack the bandages, which isn't the important part. But mummies have double its human strength, 1.5 times its original con, and 2/3 of its original dex. So they're stronger. They have more constitution, but they're slightly slower, which is typical of your classic Egyptian mummy. And as natural... as everyone would assume, fire is bad for mummies. Extremely bad, because desiccated.
Anything that's that dried out and desiccated.
Yeah. And plus they're wrapped in kindling.
Yeah, if they are wrapped. Now, they don't always have to be. They do have 2 points of armor because of their skin. So they end up with 2 points of armor for their skin. Impaling weapons don't do anything unless it's actually severing a limb or a head or something like that. Mm-hmm. Skills, the only skills they get in this book is move quietly at 50% and stalk at 40%, which I can see that, I suppose.
I'm not right away seeing the difference between move silently and stalk. I think that should be pretty much the same thing.
Maybe stalk is like specifically following one person.
Right, stalking is when you're actively... Mm-hmm. tracking one individual down or a group of individuals down without being noticed. That's stalking. Moving silently is just when you're just moving around without making noises. Does that make sense?
These are vestiges of an older edition.
Well, this is Malleus Monstrorum, and I think it came out with 5.6, right? But it's not that old. So, anyway.
Anyway.
Sandloss is 1/1d8. Sandloss is 1/1d8. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they're kind of humanoid. Yeah. That makes sense.
They're risen dead.
Yeah.
I was going to mention that there are many different kinds. Like you said, they're not all wrapped, and there are many different kinds of zombies.
Slip of the tongue.
There are many. There are many kinds of mummies around the world, and that's one way you can kind of be creative with it. There are those weird Peruvian mummies with the elongated heads that where the children's heads are bound and uh-huh. you know, there's those ones in Mexico, Guanajuato, Mexico, where a lot of them are buried alive, so they are mummified inside a tomb, and they so their face is in a rictus of horror. Often their jaws are open, or they have bite marks from having bitten themselves to death.
There's my favorite mummies are the Japanese Buddhist monks that switch over the last several years of their life. They switch over to a tree bark and nut diet, and basically self-mummify themselves while they're still alive by increasing the tannin and rosin levels in their flesh to impressive amounts, which in a game terms I think would actually give them more of a armor than just the 2 points, because it makes their skin extremely durable.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. And they look extremely lifelike too. If you haven't seen those before, that's it's very frightening to look at, just because they're usually sitting in a lotus position, and they've quietly died that way. And they're brown though. That's what's really. I mean, they're all brown. I suppose all mummies are desiccated and brown. This is almost like a polished wood look brown though. It's very strange.
Hmm.
Awesome.
But that's good fodder right there for a game.
But somebody who's from that kind of culture, you could also play with expectations of how they would behave as a mummy, you know, as an actual, you know, conscious and mobile mummy. You know, it might actually be an okay guy just dead.
Right.
Okay, you know, guy. If he's a monk, you know, what he wouldn't necessarily be in the mode of, you know, oh, well, living people are now my food or servants or enemies. It's, you know, it could just be somebody who wants to be left alone so he can continue meditating in this state of existence.
Yeah, or someone who wants to lead a flock at any cost.
Sure. Yeah, I think you could come up with sinister angles, too, for sure.
Yeah, I think that would be an interesting angle, what Dan is talking about, to have a mummy NPC that was kind of like a...
like a ghoul that should that help.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not just a helper, but that is like the leader almost, you know, where you would have this character as a figurehead sort of person.
Yeah.
You know, like, we don't know what to do. Well, let's go ask Brother Jacob or whatever the you know. And you go and talk to this almost wooden mummified monk.
Yeah, that would be fairly high pulp flavor for a game, unless you really played up the oddness of it to keep it in the horror feel. Because otherwise, that could very easily feel very
that would be pulpy. As all get out,
I'm all for it, because I think that would be great to have somebody like that as a resource.
Well, and it's interesting, keepers can mine movies and literature to get inspiration for how to run mummies. A couple that spring to mind for me is any fans of Mike Mignola's Hellboy and the sister book BPRD would be familiar with, and of course her name escapes me right now, but in the BPRD book, there's a character, a woman, and she is moved around in a wheelchair and everything, but she's a mummy. She's a mummy that, you know, has come back to life, and she, you know, is just basically used for advice and counsel, and she has got a pet cat that she keeps with her and everything, but she's a mummy, and Mike Mignola is so good about doing these unique twists on different types of creatures, like a ghost is part of the team, and you know, just all these different things.
I think her name is Panya.
And then that's it. Yes. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that's a good book. BPRD is a great book.
I've not read any of the BPRD stuff, and I really should. Yeah, I love Hellboy.
And then another, I'm not sure if you guys talked about this when I was incognito. I think the Mummy's Curse had killed me off earlier. But
we said the exact same thing.
David Wellington is an author who is really cut his teeth and made his mark in the literature world by doing unique takes and spins on classic monsters and doing, you know, taking those old tropes and turning them on their ear. So he has a trilogy of novels that's his monster series. So he's got Monster Nation, Monster Island, or no, it's Monster Island, Monster Nation, Monster Planet. That's the order. And it's a zombie book. But one of the types of zombies that he has in there are mummies. He considers them zombies that have surpassed their need for hunger. And they're very similar to how Murph was describing in the Call of Cthulhu stat book, where they're extremely strong, extremely durable, and just these, they're just like these drones, you know, and in that series of books, they act like bodyguards for one of the big bads. And it's just really cool. He just gives these little orders and suddenly the zombies go into action, but they don't move a muscle until they're told to. But that's a good series of books to check out if you want to see a new twist on mummies and zombies.
Now, the one other thing that I will mention about mummies is that Call of Cthulhu doesn't mention any spells for mummies, which I think is almost wrong. I really think that they should have spells, and mainly but I'm kind of biased here because I grew up playing things like Mummy the Resurrected from White Wolf, where it was heavily based, where you play the mummy, and you have this heavy Egyptian magic system going on with a lot of, you know, elemental control and stuff like that. I think some of that taken to not as much as it is there, obviously, but some of that can lend a huge amount of horror and, well, make that baddie even worse if you give them to a mummy.
Yeah.
So just a couple spells, I would think.
The BRP source, rule book, you know, the gold book, it actually does mention mummies as potentially having spells of different types. So, yeah, I highly recommend the BRP rulebook as a secondary source to your Cthulhu games because it has other takes on all sorts of cool stuff like that.
I'm pulling it off the shelf right now.
That's awesome. One thing I wanted to maybe mention is, did you guys listen to Monster Talk when they had a guest on, Carol Travis Hennikoff. Carol Travis Hennikoff. And she wrote about the practice of eating human flesh in Europe and how the mummies originally were thought to have healing properties. And so in the 16th and part of the 17th century, they were shipping mummies to Europe to be used in medicines. And so there was this whole kind of underground trade. And then as time went on, they ran out of mummies and they started to cure human flesh in God knows what kind of situation and started shipping human flesh from North Africa, cured somehow, and because it was so popular to be used in these medicines. So one of the things I was thinking is that it is a good backdrop for a potential scenario or a way to get a mummy in.
That's an episode of Monster Talk?
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
I'm going to have to find that. I haven't heard that one.
It's fantastic. Carol Travis Hennikoff.
Yeah, we'll have to find that and throw it up in the show notes. I love Monster Talk. That show is such a wealth of potential plot hooks.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that a podcast?
Yes. Yeah.
I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, it's a really fun show. They're on hiatus right now, so it actually, right now is the perfect time to jump in on that show because they're having a, they're basically taking the summer off. So you have the opportunity to catch up.
It is 11:09:07. I just put the link in the show notes.
Cool.
Okay.
Here's just real quick, out of the BRP book, is the powers for mummies out of there, according to BRP. It says, mummies may remember sorcery from their former existence, though they rarely improve their abilities or learn new spells. A sorcerer using mummy will usually have the following spells in memory: Brazier of Power, Gift of the Earth, Pox, Sorcerer's Talons. If the mummy's tomb is intact, it will likely have access to its grimoire or scrolls containing many, many spells. That's very cool. I like that. I like that a lot better than
that. That is cool.
Mm-hmm.
And they get 3 points armor, too.
So
that makes sense.
If you're playing with experienced Call of Cthulhu players and they know that book inside and out, maybe grab a creature description out of the BRP book to throw at them just to kind of give them a curveball.
This is completely off subject, but opening the BRP book reminded me of this. We need to run a super-based Call of Cthulhu game.
What?
How about them apples?
Justice League takes on the Mythos.
Yeah, right there. Right there. Justice League versus the Mythos.
There was a cartoon episode that had a something very similar to that. It was it featured Solomon Grundy. I don't remember exactly what. But there was an episode of the there was an episode of the Batman animated series that I think featured something very, very Cthulhu-esque, and then there was also another one of, I think it was Superman or Justice League or something, and very mythos-y.
There's a real Ghostbusters episode, too.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I remember the real Ghostbusters.
It's sort of like Supers.
Yeah, I think we should do that. I think I've been talking about playing a complete sandbox game. Maybe we'll do that. Maybe we'll have Supers versus the Mythos.
You know what? I was thinking about this as a possible scenario idea. How about this? You know the real life superhero movement? You know what I'm talking about? What about throwing those people at the Mythos?
It would be pulp. It'd be straight comedy.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so we it'd become like Mystery Men.
Run it as a fiasco playset.
Yeah, like Mystery Men. We'd have to have. We'd have to have 10 or 15 different characters made up.
Yes.
Because without powers, that means squish.
I say give them powers. Give them a couple. Give everybody one
tasers.
Power.
You know, like taser boxing gloves.
Just give everybody one power and then just roll with that. So everybody's got their single power, but they can't do shit for anything else. You know,
would the power drain some kind of essence or sanity? Like, would it be mythos driven somehow?
Oh my God, would it be mythos driven? No, we'll use the straight rules out of the book for supers. Okay.
Yeah,
we're not going to get any crazy rules because this would be straight sandbox, and I'm not going to try and create rules along the way. That's too insane.
They just use the magic points as power points for powers.
Right, which isn't, that's use not bad at all. But I don't have points. To. Yeah, I guess we could say if you lose all your magic points, you take a sand loss as well. That would be horrifying, but basic.
Basic. Okay. So, how about...
By the way, this is just turned in. Yeah, this is just turned into another side or something, so we need to move on.
It's really bizarre. Yeah, okay.
Or make it the show focus. I don't... Jerk. Let's move on. What's next?
We're going to do the main, which is talking about how you describe things in horror gaming.
Yep, right after this word, our sponsor.
CryptoCurium.com presents An Outing to Ogden Pond with Jimmy and the Professor.
Oh, isn't this nice? The true beauty of nature right here in front of us. Houghton's Pond beneath us, and the majestic beauty of the blue hills all around. Did you know that this very body of water was formed by receding glaciers thousands of years ago?
Oh, that's very interesting, Professor. Now, can you pass me that can of worms? I might as well get some fishing in while we're here.
Oh, here you are, Jimmy. You know, I haven't been fishing since I was a boy in Oxford.
Willikers! I snapped my pole! Well, I'll just mend it real fast. Here, this'll do.
Ah, yes. I do believe it reminds me of Shelley. He will watch from dawn to gloom, the lake reflected sun illume, the yellow bees and the ivy bloom, nor heed nor see what things they be.
Very nice, Professor.
Oh, have you read Shelley, Jimmy?
Oh, no, Professor. I never really went in for poetry. I always had a liking to Tosca, though.
Jimmy, I'm surprised. I never... Oh, I think you have something there, Jimmy.
Yes, sir. And it's a big one.
Hold on, let me get the net.
Professor, it's pulling us.
Oh, this is not good at all. Here, let me help. Oh, what did you fix your rod with there?
Just some old piece of wood I found lying in the boat.
Good Lord, Jimmy. That's the rod of Zarthamog.
Ah! Our horse, Jimmy. That's a yug. What happened?
The rod broke. No doubt sending that unwholesome beast back to the depths of the Pacific where it belongs.
Well, that was lucky, I suppose.
Yes, too lucky for me. Well, this confirms it.
What, Professor?
We're taking no more field trips. Not for a while, at least.
This has been an outing with Jimmy and the Professor. Brought to you by Cryptocurium.com for your Cthulhu Mythos replica needs.
Settle down now, class. It's time for your next lesson.
This week, we're going to be talking about tips for describing things in your games.
For effective horror gaming.
Things like moody landscapes, weird evidence, indescribable monsters, and gore.
Yeah.
The
problem with indescribable things in a role-playing game is that you have to describe everything.
That's right. Is that you can't describe
you have to describe.
So what do you do? How do you handle that, guys?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there are ways to play with that. But you basically have to cheat and say, you know, that something is indescribable and then go on to describe it.
No,
with difficulty.
I disagree. I tend to do less is more kind of thing. For instance, and we've talked about this before, and haven't we talked about this before? For instance, and this is my example that I think I've used in an earlier show, with the biochi, you know, how to describe the biochi. And instead of describing the biochi as reading it from the book, you know, you can just say, take one aspect of that beast, whichever beast it may be, we'll take the biochi in this case, and you hear those leather flapping wings. So you hear the flapping wings and this god-awful shriek. You don't actually have to see it, you know, and you don't have to describe it. And that way they don't know entirely what it is, because it could be a biochi, it could be a shantak, it could be a... who knows what, you know? And you want to
could be a cat in heat.
And you want to keep that as vague as possible, because these guys, especially guys who've played it forever, they're gonna know. I mean, that's kind of what we do is, you know, you play a new scenario and you're like, oh, it's deep ones. This is a deep one scenario. You know what I mean? And so you want to try and keep them guessing for as long as possible.
I think that's what I mean, though. I'm not saying that you don't, because what you did is describe it. You described a portion of it. You have to use something
aspect.
Yeah, you have to describe it. Otherwise,
I mean, Lovecraft himself does this, where he says it's indescribable fish essence, you know, flopping sound. Well, that is description. Right. You know.
Yeah.
So that's the cheat. That's the cheat, is not to say that you describe it in full, but that you say you role play the difficulty in describing it in a way. You know, you are taking on like seeing through the eyes of someone who can't describe what they're seeing.
I'll do is I'll take it from the eyes of the player seeing it. You know, and so you have to you have to relate it to them. So you just
totally
take
agree
it how they're viewing it. And especially if they failed their sand roll, you should probably roll the sand ahead of time. That way you know how crazy you can go. If they pass it, then it might be only a mild shock and you can be kind of blah in your description. However, if they fail it, then you can just fall out nuts. But and you don't even have to, if they fail the sand roll, it doesn't even have to be what you're describing, because they've gone nuts, so it doesn't matter. So they could see a mummy and you describe a biochi.
Yeah, their perceptions may be completely out of whack.
And that's a good one.
What they're thinking it is.
That is a great idea.
So when they fail their sand roll, you know, and you have a mummy coming at them and you describe a freaking biochi flying towards them and they're looking up in the sky to shoot it or whatever. And then all of a sudden, a round or two later, they don't see it because they've just been gutted by this giant mummy. You know, that, oops, sorry, you failed your sand roll, dude. You know? I mean, you wouldn't tell them that, but you know what I mean. That's just another way of handling that.
Yeah, I think actually that's a good tip for description of anything, is looking through the PC's eyes, because actually Trail of Cthulhu kind of codifies this, where you walk into a room and the evidence that a botanist finds is different than the evidence that a cop finds.
Right.
Because they're seeing the world through their eyes, and you can point, go to a particular player and a particular who has a particular character and tell it directly right. to them what they see, and that you know, if it's a monster, you could do that, but also with anything, with the mood, with the scene. I had a character who was a botanist in a recent game, and it happened to sort of take place outside, and it was awesome to be able to describe the world through through the plants. And you know, the seeing a trail in the woods, you know, and talking about the species, and you know, how things are strange to him because they don't add up naturally, as opposed to, say, the housewife character in that story, which would see things in a much more kind of a domestic, through a domestic lens.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great, taking their profession and character focuses into account for their descriptions.
Yeah, because, I mean, truly, they're all going to have different viewpoints of whatever they're seeing. It's all going to be influenced by their own experience and, academic background, if they have any at all, emotional state. And that's why Sand comes into prominence there.
Absolutely.
I love that idea about, you know, seeing what was their sand roll result and then gauging how you describe and how horrific you describe
Thank
it
you,
based upon their role.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's a good little tip.
Yeah, if they get a really bad sand roll, give them a sharp, accurate description
of something else.
or even go beyond
that's
and just
what
inflate
I've
it
I've
to
I've done that in the past where I had a guy who was actually coming up against something mundane. I want to call it a Hound of Tyndalos. Yeah, it was a Hound of Tyndalos. Okay. I was thinking of a Displacer Beast for some reason. I had that on my mind. And I was getting the names mixed up. Oh, no, I know.
Wrong game.
But
wrong
anyway,
game.
It was a Hound of Tyndalos. But he failed his sand roll, and he failed it bad, right? And then I made him roll the sand loss, and he got like the full D6 version, you know? You know, like, oh, shit. You just lost 6 points of sand for seeing this crazy looking dog. So, I mean, I didn't describe a dog to him. I described a child of the woods, you know, the spawn of Shit and Girth, and because that's far more frightening, you know, to see this giant thing coming at him. And he was looking up and around, and he could hear the stomping and the, you know, coming at him through the field. Unfortunately, he was the only one hearing it. The rest of the guys were, you know, realizing that they had just glimpsed this thing they shouldn't have glimpsed and were trying to get the hell out of Dodge. And he was frozen in fear as it came up and then eventually killed him. But, you know, sand roll sucks. That's what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. One of the examples that we heard recently with New Orleans Mythos is describing something through the eyes of the characters, where he talked about the spawn of Ihort being
right, that was
oysters
a good idea.
Yeah.
To make it kind of Louisiana flavor.
Yeah, that's a simile that would come to the minds of somebody in that area of that the size and shape and texturing of it would fit that kind of a organism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the way also that I've kind of tried to do things is sort of take the same tack that Spielberg did for Jaws, of just glimpses and bits and pieces.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
The Jaws approach works for so many things.
I think if you combine that with the other of viewing it through their eyes and coupled with the sand roll ahead of time, you can just those three things alone can really freak out players to where they have no fucking idea what's going on. You know, and that's where you want them, because with experienced players, like I said earlier, they're going to try and pick out. Even if you're not trying to, you're going to know, you know, this is set by the sea. So that narrows it down. It's either, you know, we got bunions and deep ones. I bet it's deep ones. You know, and then as it goes, oh, he looks funny. It's fucking deep ones. I got it. It's deep ones. You know what I mean? That's always going on in your head when you're playing one of these games. So as long as you can keep them guessing, the longer and longer they can be kept guessing, the better the game's going to be for them. It's just going to be more fun.
Yeah. And the players don't want to necessarily know right away what it is they're dealing with. They like having that little bit of unknown. There was a recent release on Skype of Cthulhu where Jim was the keeper. It was called Power Corrupt. It was a game, a scenario he created that the descriptions of the creatures, it took me a little bit to puzzle out exactly what it was he was working with. And that was great. That I didn't right off the bat know what the main creature was in the story. And once I did, I went, oh, yeah. Okay, yeah, those previous hints, they all make sense
now. And on another sense, I just played Paul Fricker's Dockside Dogs last night with Shannon from the forums as the GM. And I had never read this scenario beforehand because I'd always wanted to play it, so I had always kind of avoided it. And I am glad I did. So I had no idea what the deal was at the very end. I had no clue what's happening. And it was because of that, it was quite literally one of the funnest games I'd been in years.
Awesome. One of the things that I wanted to float that I'm seeing kind of in the culture of other games and in a scenario that Jason Morningstar wrote for Unspeakable, where you ask questions of the players in order to get a little description from them, especially if you want to tie it in some personal way. It's kind of out there for, you know, what we used to do in the 80s, but when you can ask for a personal kind of connection to what they see, especially with hallucinations or things that they don't understand what they're seeing, kind of interview them about what their character, what might have happened to their character when they were little, what was so horrible that day, why did you suppress this memory, and then what do you see?
So he does this ahead of time, before the game?
Yeah, so in that scenario.
Like character creation.
Yeah, exactly. So you have a conversation,
about that before, though, haven't we? Where
I've done questionnaires.
Where you try and get little infos of character background so that you could screw them with it later. I mean, that's what you use it for.
Right. but you can also do it in the moment without even with leading questions when it comes up. I mean, you want to have some basis so you know.
I mean, can you give me an example? Because I'm not following what you're saying entirely.
Sure. So you set it up ahead of time so that you know the characters, right?
Right.
And I'm trying not to
look,
spoil
I'm me.
A...
Look, I'm me.
Yes.
Okay. Let's do that. I'm playing myself as my character. So spoil something for me.
All right. Tell me about give me a profession. Throw it out quick.
Computer technician.
All right. Oh, God. Okay. So what was it? What happened that day when you were lost?
Am I physically lost or lost in my brain?
Yeah, you were lost. What happened?
Oh, I got lost. When you
were a child.
I was late for an appointment. I was supposed to fix mm-hmm. lady's computer, and I couldn't get there because I took a couple of wrong turns and ended up on the wrong side of the county.
Okay, and had you ever been down that road before?
No.
And was it difficult when your car got stuck?
I see. Yes, it was very difficult.
So what was it that you didn't understand that you were hearing in the woods that day?
I could not make the correlation between this freaky noises coming out of the woods and the swastikas that were spray painted on the road signs.
Whoa.
Okay.
And that's why it freaks you out right now in the present when you start to see notice that there are swastikas embossed in the doorway as you walk in.
Oh, I gotcha.
So you're pulling something
you're pulling
from your
that and then straight back into the game that
yeah, yeah.
That that's was kind
good.
Of a,
I like that.
Not
a, it's like doing a flashback.
Right, exactly.
I like that. That's neat.
And then also talking about description, bringing it back to description. I'm not sure that was the best riff there, but
that was pretty good.
But then asking, like, then what did it look like, and what did it smell like, and what did that sound like, and kind of like drawing someone into what is kind of their own making, mm-hmm. their own dream, or their own.
So could
you know,
we do that with a sand roll as well? So like, let's say
absolutely right.
So like,
yeah.
you've just failed your sand roll on you've just glimpsed a biaki or something, you know, the typical biaki,
mm-hmm.
And you failed your sand roll. So then, how would you do that? Like, let's say I've just failed my sand roll to look at a biaki. What would you ask me?
Well,
I'm putting you on the spot. So
you are. I mean, I sort of don't know the character.
So could I do it like this? Let's say you failed your biaki sand roll, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm the keeper. Could I ask you something like, what is that thing that you smell right now?
Yeah, sure, right. Yeah, it smells acrid, chemical.
That chemical odor?
Yeah.
Can you almost feel that metallic taste in the back of your throat?
It's in my lungs a little bit.
That's because the Biaki's thrown down your face. So that's, I mean, that makes sense.
Right.
8 points of damage.
And another way, you know, another way, the questionnaire, because I think this is where you're going, Chad, is you could, when the characters are being created, and this is actually a method used in the game of Dread. Your entire character in Dread is built up by answering a questionnaire.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
And then you play the Jenga game.
Right.
But you could, when your players are creating their characters, especially if a keeper wanted to go with a campaign type of, you know, thing where you're going to set these guys up for long-term play, maybe have a personal session with each player and say, look, you know, everybody's childhoods are not 100% perfect. Describe a difficult time in your childhood. Was it a tragedy? You know, were you lost in the woods or lost at the mall? Or, you know, describe something that was difficult and scary, but, you know, maybe, you know, you don't have to put it in mythos context. Just try, you know, something mundane. And then once each character has a background like that, and then you start your campaign, you're getting into something with the mythos, say with the Biaki, you kind of put a pin, you know, pause the scenario and quickly go to that character who's having the encounter with the creature and say, hey, before we go any further, tell me about that back, you know, that thing you put in your background. Give me some hints, you know, did you see something? Did you smell something? And then as soon as they give you an element that you can use, you return to the present, you return to the normal game and say, that element that you remember, it's here now, whether yeah. it's a sound or a sight or a exactly. taste or something. And now you're tying this horror that the character's encountering in their life right now to something that they have already encountered as, you know, in their past, whether it be a month ago or, you know, 10 years ago, you're tying that in to that character's background.
Absolutely right. Yeah, that's what
idea.
I'm talking about.
I like that. That's
so so like you're when you were a child and you were lost, you had something in your hand that kind of gave you comfort. What was that thing? Oh, it was a toy. Okay. What kind of toy? It was a doll. Well, that's the thing, because right now you find that doll and its eyes are alive and it's looking at you. You know, you sort of like yes. bring it back around. Yeah.
Or I lost my mother's chamomile and now it's dangling from that creature's neck. You know.
Yes, right.
Oh, that's
right.
Freaky. Okay, let's move on from this type of description and move to talk about, like, how do you create the moody landscape type thing? You know, how do you
right.
do that? So, what do you guys do to kind of set the mood?
Something I jotted down about tips is that with NPCs or with scenes, I like to have three descriptors. Or three, you know, pieces of like specificity, something that I can draw on. So that's one way. Because you don't really need a lot of detail, but if you have, you know, three really good details that you think up ahead of time, you know, pull out adjectives, pull out a specific sight, smell, appeal to the senses, then you're on your way. With three, you know, you can sort of riff the rest.
I think we should talk about mood music as well. Music in general can set the tone, and lighting. Music and lighting combined can make a game so much better when you're playing with a group around the table. It doesn't do much good for Skype games and stuff like that. But when you have a live group, if you have the proper music going and you've dimmed the lights, or as if and numerous other people have done this where they play by candlelight or something like that. I mean, that just adds to the mood of the game, especially if you're doing it dark, which, you know, horror games should be played in the darkness, if you ask me. I don't think you should be doing it noon or anything like that, just because it helps add to the ambiance of the game at whole.
I agree. Yeah.
With current technology, it actually has gotten a lot easier to be able to use sound and that kind of ambiance in a game more easily. You know, it used to be a real pain to try and put together like a cassette, because yeah. I've tried
we still don't. I mean, even you're talking about a live game.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the guys. What is the guy's name on Yogg that makes those unbelievable, like, 4-hour soundscapes?
Alicorn.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, all you have to do now is just get two of those songs and you're good for an entire session. You know what I mean? They're themed already, so you don't have to worry about it. That's the easy
I think route. Also what you're talking about is Grace Hopper's soundscapes.
Grace Hopper.
The Egyptian one that lasts like five hours.
Those are the long ones. Yeah.
Yeah, those are Grace Hopper's.
Those are awesome, though. I mean, that's perfect for trying to set that mood and getting it going. Because whether the players realize it or not, that's influencing them themselves as opposed to their character and then therefore their character. But as long as you can, anything you can do to try and get your gamers into that zone where you need them, you know, to kind of willingly have that suspension of disbelief happening on its own, it's going to make life so much easier for you as a keeper.
Mm-hmm.
And the game, you know, this is a cooperative, you know, group setting game. And if the group is not in that mood, if they're not looking to do a dark and dour and, you know, super scary Call of Cthulhu, if they instead want to do a light romp, you know, and laugh and joke throughout the game, you know, that's what the players are going to do. I have one game that was recorded and it's out there, the Faculty Party. Yes, it's the, I don't know if y'all have heard it. I recorded that. It was one of the few games that wasn't recorded at an actual con. I recorded it at a house. I was playing with some folks, and we were fortunate enough that there was a thunderstorm going on, and you could hear it in the recording. You know, the thunder was so loud and so close, and the rain was pelting the windows, and it would have been awesome, except the players just wanted to joke and have fun. You know, and so that's what we ended up doing. It ended up being just a romp through this instead of a stealthy, you know, crawl.
When you bring up rain, though, that's a perfect example, though. There's numerous websites out there that do nothing but like rain and thunder soundscapes that just loop for hours upon hours online. You just open a web page and there it is. I think one of them's rain.com or something like rain.fm or something like that. But those alone will help immensely, because most people are inherently, the first fear that they ever had was of the dark, and the second one was of thunder. You know what I mean? And so that, sure. I mean, that just creates more of that ambiance that you want in order to try and get your guys to be a little bit more on edge. Just, you don't want to, I mean, we're not trying to scare your gamers, and that's not going to happen. But anything that you can do in order.
I disagree.
Okay, you can, but it's not easy. Let's go that route. Especially with experienced Call of Cthulhu players, especially, you know what I mean? They've seen most of everything. But anything like that is going to just make them, put them a little bit more off, you know what I mean? So that they're just slightly more unexpecting of what might be happening. Because every once in a while, you get that moment where they fail a sand roll and the thunder booms in the background or something, and it just makes it perfect, you know what I mean? Everybody gets quiet real quick, like, oh my god, what the hell is going on?
Yeah, I'm a full-on believer in using audio as much as you can, not just music, but those background sound effects, because there's something mysterious that I don't even think we understand well about how sound transports you to a place more than watching a film in a lot of ways. In fact, the sound, you know, helps a film, but when you are listening to something, puts your imagination there really efficiently and you know
the
immersively.
Perfect example would be the silent era, or even better than that, I think, would be the latest, or not the latest, I'm sorry, but the Call of Cthulhu movie from HPLHS, where it was a silent movie, but their soundtrack was fantastic, mm-hmm. and just matched up perfectly with that movie. And it really, that movie would have been crap with a crappy soundtrack. You know what I mean? But because they had such a good music going back down to it, it was just phenomenal.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've had the pleasure of seeing Nosferatu on a big screen with a live organist accompanying.
Oh wow, that must be awesome. Was that the original?
It was fantastic.
The 72 remake.
Oh no, it was the original Nosferatu.
I actually like the remake that they made in the '70s. That's a great version of Nosferatu. Especially,
I don't think I've ever seen that.
You have to track it down. It's not easy to find, but there at the very beginning, it's the Black Plague and whatnot. And they must have trucked in rats from all over freaking Europe in order to film those scenes. I mean, the ships come into the dock at the very beginning, and it's literally covered in rats, and they're real rats. And it's just, oh, it's so disconcerting. And you can hear just the rat sounds skittering around and chirping and stuff. It's just very off-putting. Which is exactly what they were going for. So it was brilliant.
Mm. Awesome.
Yeah.
Sounds are a great way to convey emotion.
So let's move on from sound and mood stuff and talk about, I guess, weird evidence. I guess, Dan, you were talking more about like handouts and stuff of that nature.
Yeah.
Because that can add a huge amount to a game.
Absolutely. I personally love handouts. I think that's one of the strongest aspects of the game, of Call of Cthulhu specifically, is that handouts are a staple of this particular game, and it really brings people in. And when you're dealing with a creature, the evidence left behind of an attack can be done as handouts in one way or another. And so you don't have to describe something, because all they're doing is seeing the aftermath, and they'll come up with what it looks like.
And we've talked about this before with our attempt at a scenario based around a prop. And I think the props are the other side of that, where, you know, you have your handouts, which is one thing. But if you can present a live physical 3D object that is, you know, this is what they found, or this is what was there, or this is the idol that they were all praying to, or whatever, that just blows the mind of many gamers, because a lot of times you just don't have that opportunity. So whenever you get a chance to, that's an absolute fantastic way in order to bring that mood and that that sense of dread back into it. You know, you're just trying to remind them that they're not playing a game at that point, and that just helps them slide further and further into character, whether it's pulp or not, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I have a dagger, I guess is what I would call it. It's, you know, from bottom of the hilt to the tip of the sheath. It's probably 18 inches long, and it's when it's sheathed and you don't see the blade, the hilt and the sheath, it looks like it's carved bone, like a spine, and, you know, other, you know, it's just, it's really, it looks really, you know, horrific and everything. But then when you pull the blade out, It looks like a really, I forget what they're called, but it looks like a short katana. It has that type of blade where it's flat on one side. It's got like a chiseled tip of the, okay. And then it's only sharp on one edge and then the chisel tip, you know, and the blade itself is probably maybe only 12 inches long, you know, but it looks so modern compared to this, you know, what looks like a ancient, you know, bone sheath and handle and everything. And I'm waiting for, I haven't built it yet, but I want to try and create some sort of scenario where this knife is like the centerpiece, and I want to take it to a game and just, you know, plop that on the table and go, here's the ceremonial dagger you found. And then let the players be able to pick it up and feel the bone texture and pull the blade out and everything. And so,
yeah, or don't tell them that it's a dagger and let them discover it.
Right. Our good friend Joe Broers actually makes a few of those that he sells on his site, where he makes these ceremonial cultist daggers out of knife blanks that he finds online. And then he creates and sculpts this hilt that goes on it, and they look fantastic. And they're actually fairly reasonably priced for the amount of work that he must put into those for each one. They each end up coming out fairly unique. Even the ones with the same handle, because the blades are typically different each time. And so they look just fantastic. There's a number of other people who do that as well, especially if you search on like Etsy. You can find a number of like ceremonial type daggers based around that theme. And if you want to go pulp, you know, steampunk is your friend, man. And there is more steampunk crap out there than you can shake a stick at. So,
yeah.
Like with
a little bit of it is actually really good.
Yeah. Some of it is just fantastic. And it's just one more thing that you can use as a keeper in your arsenal, trying to get that, those players to forget that they're playing a game. And that's really what you're there for. Oh, you want to talk about gore?
Oh.
Well, we could. I wanted to ask about something that I tried in a Viking game a while back about gore, which was to get the players to describe the gore during battle. I'm not entirely sure that I sort of am skeptical that it worked, actually. So can I put Dan on the spot? when you are in battle and you do damage... Oh, hell.
Don't get shot. Don't get shot.
God.
Speaking of sound effects.
And gore, my goodness. The mood has been set.
Wow. It's really close, whatever that is.
Joys of New York City.
Man.
Yeah.
That's not gunshots. It's fireworks. But it's like from the roof next door.
Go outside, because I want to see you on the news tomorrow.
Yeah, right. Local gamer dies as firework explodes.
Yeah, no, that wouldn't make the news.
Not New York.
But the nerd counter in Times Square would go down by one number.
That's right. That's awesome. I wish there was a nerd counter. Anyway, well, we don't have to loop back to that kind of contribution angle, but I wanted to. Oh my god. never mind.
They're having a great time, man. They're drunk. You may as well go up to the roof next door and have some fun.
Yeah.
Wow.
Why don't you guys talk for a while, and I will put myself on mute.
So,
remember last time you did that, you forgot.
Yeah, don't forget. So with gore in general, do you guys do? I mean, I know that pulp is not gory. We'll just get that out of the way right now. But do you guys describe a lot of gore, or do you find it effective at all, or do you just gloss over it and move on? Because a lot of people are actually somewhat put off by that. Even as keepers, they just don't like going that far.
I love going that far. I love doing the gore.
Do you?
I love to describe the gore. I love to describe, you know, vicious wounds and gaping wounds and, you know.
Now, the flip side of gore, not the flip side, but another aspect of gore is to describe what's truly disturbing, which is typically involves family and children. And I've used that quite a bit. And it disturbs me when I do it, let's be honest. But it really disturbs players as well. You know, seeing kids get murdered or whatever is always going to be somewhat off-putting, but it always has the same, you're just trying to, you know, shock them at that point into remembering that, you know, oh shit, something bad happened here, you know?
Yeah.
That's one of those things you really need to know your players in advance, though, because some people will just get up and leave if you push certain buttons like that.
I've never had that happen, so I don't know. I don't know if that's typical.
I could see where that could happen, which is why I wrote one that has to do with, you know, and I even put in the public description because I didn't want it to be hidden. You know, it says the fat kids in Arkham are missing, right? And so I wanted to put it out there that this scenario involves kids, you know, teenagers. And, you know, both the players and the keepers know that right from the get-go. I mean, the story opens where the investigators have been hired by a family who's looking for their son who went missing, and the police have written it off as a runaway. And they want the investigators to look for him. And, you know, right from the get-go, it should be clear to everyone that this is a scenario that's going to involve young people, and it could get horrific, and, you know, tread lightly and you know, enter if ye dare, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I love using that as a leverage, you know, as an emotional button to push on the players and to try and make them, you know, emotionally involved and invested in this scenario. But it's not one that I want to try and overdo, you know?
Right. It's not something that you can whip out every game or you're just being disturbed.
Right.
I think would be the best.
It's term. Also not the one that I want to come out of left field and blindside them with it, you know?
Right. Yeah. You want to build to that. You don't want to just leap out, you know, out of the gate and you have dead little girls laying around. That just is not what you're going for. So you right. do have to have some yeah. limits there.
You're better off having the little girl be alive and really creepy.
Yeah.
I disagree. I had a game where I ran, it was a slow buildup and it was violent from the get-go. But it culminated in them tracking down this cult member to a abandoned tenement house in Chicago where they found a pile of bones. And then as they start, well, it wasn't bones. It was like mutilated flesh and bones and bits and pieces and hair and shit and gore. You know, it was just a pile of mess. But as they investigated further, they realized that this was tiny hands and little feet and little blonde pieces of hair, and you know what I mean? It became very apparent that this were children that was in this pile, and that somebody had been chewing on them fairly recently. And that made it fairly disturbing.
Yeah, I would think so.
But like you said, I didn't blindside them with that. It wasn't a pulp game. It wasn't like the, you know, the, John's India adventure, sprinkled with dead children. That would just be weird.
Yeah. Now, gore in general, I have used it before. The adventure that I did in Wisconsin that I was trying to do my mega campaign that kind of fizzled, I actually more or less started out with a really deeply described gore scene to kind of hook them. And where I started off with, okay, you know, you're part of MAPS, and you know this particular other character, and I started things off with a really, really bad day at the hospital. And it was bad enough that I was having, like, a nurse passed out and a surgeon threw up, and because they failed their SAN rolls. And the characters didn't fare a whole lot better. And I actually tried to make that as nasty and horrific and also strange in ways that they would question how this happened and why it happened and kind of pique their curiosity, as well as, you know, making them, you know, throw up in their mouths a little bit.
Did it work?
Yeah, they were trying to hunt down what was going on, and they never got to that point of the story to really determine it. But I had it all plotted out of, you know, they can find clues in this place, in this place, in this place. And there's, you know, that's the campaign where I had the various antagonists writing letters to each other. And so a letter from one person that they might find in like a couple of different places, that they could stumble across this letter that would tell them exactly what had happened to their friend. But unfortunately, they never got to that point.
Yeah, the slow reveal is awesome. And the imagined, the filling in the imagination. So, I mean, the gore, describing gore or harm in some way is one thing. But then if it stops there, it's kind of a dead end. It's learning what might have caused it, or that normal explanations don't do the job. That to me is really the horror of it, versus the kind of gross out, or the you know, which works also. But that, you know, like a body falling, let's say, and it cracks the pavement. I think I saw something on YSDC recently about this, and I think it was that somebody had figured out, like, well, the forces that would have to be involved in cracking the pavement from, say, a 9-story fall, it wouldn't happen, because bodies just don't do that. And there's sort of discussion about whether that might actually be more creepy, you know, to figure out that some other forces must have been involved when you do the math. You know, there's one thing describing a lump of body that has taken falling damage. It's another thing to, you know, to investigate and to go deep.
And in my case, you know, it wasn't somebody was stabbed and gutted by some unknown monster. It was a guy that they had known and was talking to, laying in a hospital bed, and he then had a fit in an attack, and he vomited out his own organs.
Oh.
That is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah,
I like that a lot.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Your own organs. Oh, shit, my spleen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the skeletal system was starting to dissolve, and all of his muscles were contracting in a way that was forcing everything inside out.
That's cool.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was a bad day in the hospital.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, so hopefully that helps everybody a little bit, I guess. We kind of rambled there for a little bit, at least I did, which I'm known for.
No.
No, not at all, right? But hopefully that helps maybe give some keepers some ideas about how they can help their game along on the creep aspect of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to throw this out to the listener world, and let's use this thread in the forum, because I think this is something that everybody has ideas about, and it'd be awesome to hear from some of our experienced keepers and new keepers about ideas.
Yeah, we love the conversations and the feedback, and the people who have been running this game for a while have come up with all sorts of different techniques that they've found works with this group or that group. And one thing that always I've always been curious about is, how can you make something particularly creepy, like at a convention? Because, well, you're in a noisy, well-lit room surrounded by hundreds of people sometimes. You know, that's not exactly the atmosphere to make things creepy.
I think the key there is to secure a private room.
I mean, that's not always an option.
I know that's not always an option, but I think if you can do that, you're well along the way to making that better.
I think the key is to, it's not necessarily true that people will be afraid or, you know, horrified in the moment, but if you can give them something to take away, to revisit when they, you know,
like
maybe talking about
finger?
It later, that, what?
We're not cutting off any of Dan's fingers, okay? Dan needs his fingers. We're not selling those on eBay.
I need to type.
No, I have some con games coming up, so I'm just collecting my wife's fingers at this time, so that as a going away prize for all my players. Here's
John,
a little bit of my wife. Here you go,
John. We might be calling the cops here in just a few minutes. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's just
we have mailed you stuff in the past. We
no
have
no
your
keep
address.
Him, keep him on the. Keep him on the podcast. Keep him, busy. Keep him on the podcast. Keep him busy.
She's not screaming yet. Oh Lord.
Sure.
Can I drop one?
Why not, John?
Can I drop
did.
One yeah, thing? Sure. Which is just that I looked up. Ah, yeah, he dropped 10 things. I had looked up, you know, description stuff on the YSDC forum to see if this had come up before. And one thing I thought was pretty awesome is somebody compiled a list of words that Lovecraft used to describe his monsters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? It's
yeah,
from
it's
a
from
post in 2003. Yeah, but let me just drop it here in the show notes. It's a pretty awesome resource, and I think it's a good idea, going back three descriptors, to bring in some of the either Lovecraftian words or whatever flavor you're going with to
I just
set the tone.
Some
of them are silly,
down and
but
the first thing
you know.
I saw was jangling.
So we run with that.
If you have a copy of the first Cthulhu Companion that Chaosium put out, at the very back of that,
that's
they
where
have something
it comes
called
from.
The Sanity Quiz, and I was very intrigued. I was like, well, I want to take a sanity quiz, and then you go to it, and all it is just two pages of just words. Is like these are words that Lovecraft used. Although when I was going through that, I noticed one word is not in there, which was of course I say that now, I can't think of it.
Squamous
isn't on the list.
You know what? It turns out that Lovecraft. Correct me if I'm wrong. I pull this from Cthulhu Chick. Who is part of the Clark Ashton Smith podcast.
Love that
awesome
podcast.
She did some analysis of words because she put together a whole e-file of all of Lovecraft's work, and so she could do a search, stuff. I think squamous only comes up one time in all of his stories.
That is so hard to believe, but it's such a good word.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah, the fan base has definitely latched on to squamous.
Totally.
Yeah. Well, squamous. I mean, how can you go wrong there?
Yeah.
It's
one of those words that even if you don't know the true definition, it describes what you... It sounds slimy.
Exactly like it is, so it's great.
Mm-hmm. And,
on a side note, I got connected tangentially through for some posting on Facebook. Somebody had just had a baby, and they were saying, what should we name our baby? And I put Squamous in there, and, and people were just going, you know, they were just flaming me from that, you know, but I thought...
That's awesome. Yeah.
You know, I don't know who these people are. I'll just put Squamous. Why not?
Turns out it was your sister-in-law or something.
Mm-hmm. We want to hear from our listeners, and we've got a lot of different ways for you guys to get in touch with us.
Our main contact email address is feedback@mu-podcast.com. We also have a Twitter account @mu_podcast.
We have our Providence, Rhode Island voicemail number. It's area code 401-400-MUP. That's 401-400-0687. Ask a question, leave us a liner, say who you are, and I'm enrolled at the Miskatonic University podcast. And give us a hearty Go Pods for our home team, the Fighting Cephalopods.
Our website is www.mu-podcast.com, and you find our show notes for this episode at mu-podcast.com/34. That's the number 34.
And our forums are at mu-podcast.com/campus. We also have a thread on the ogsothoth.com forums and Mythophonia section, so please join us there.
And sign up for the show in iTunes and use the RSS feed found on the website. Please, on iTunes, leave us a comment and rate us.
And if you have any events or news to share, go to mu-podcast.com/guest to be a guest on the website. And you can also join me sometimes on the IRC channel at @MiskatonicU on Freenode.
Thank you for joining us for another episode. Class is dismissed.
The Call of Cthulhu role-playing game is property of Chaosium, Inc. The written works of H.P. Lovecraft are held in the United States public domain. All other works mentioned in this podcast are the property of their respective owners. Original content of this show is copyright of the Miskatonic University podcast under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license.
I just played Paul. Shut up. Mummies may remember.
The BBC would like to announce that the next scene is not considered suitable for family viewing.
Oh shit! Wait, fuck! God damn!
What?
Hang on! Fuck hell! Fire! Fire!
Shit!
God damn! Shit!
The hell!
Did you catch one of those fireworks? Fire,
seriously.
Really?
It's all good now. Go ahead.
No way. Are you inside?
God, Jesus, fuck.
I'm sorry. I was smoking a pipe, and I dropped the pipe, and a huge fucking cherry fell out all over me and the carpet, and a piece of paper that was on the floor, and things just got real, real fast.
Wow.
I've never done that before. That's horrible.
And it's been immortalized in
Well, that better make it to the end of the show.
Yeah.
In the middle.
That's awesome.
That's all I'm saying.
No, that'll be at the
end. And me being between that and me being under mortar fire, it's...
I think it should just be a short show with a long fucking outtake at the back. Yeah, mostly outtake. Right. So we can mostly just... And we'll just end it here in just a few minutes and be like, we tried, guys. We did, really. That was the only 20 minutes of the show we got. The rest of the 85 minutes is outtakes. Have a nice day.
Is yeah. Fires and explosives.
And there's a thunderstorm rolling into my area. I just saw a flash of lightning, so yay.
Oh my god, it's like a cursed show.
This is a cursed show.
Are you my mummy?